Hi there. Can we have everyone take their seats? We don't have this problem at our other venues. Hi there. I'm Natalie Turvey, Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. Good evening. And welcome to tonight's CJF J-Talk, Vice, the New Establishment. Our hashtag for tonight's conversation is CJF J-Talk, if you'd like to join the conversation on Twitter. Our thanks to tonight's sponsor, Molson Coors, for hosting us at this fantastic venue, the Beer Academy, and for sponsoring our reception tonight. CJF J-Talks regularly feature the innovators and disruptors that are shaking the foundations of the media industry. Vice Media has built its brand on edgy, unconventional, provocative journalism, telling stories that other news outlets don't tell, and taking audiences into places around the world they might not know well. Rolling Stone magazine said that their HBO series feels a little like your buddy from the bar just having to be wandering through eastern Afghanistan with a camera crew. We're thrilled to have Vice Media co-founder Sarush Alvi here tonight to talk about Vice's journey from Montreal Magazine to media conglomerate, what drives their brand of journalism, and Vice's plans to boost its news operation. Our host for tonight's J-Talk is a fearless personality in Canadian journalism and one of the legends of CBC. Anna Maria Tremonti has been on the ground in more than 30 countries. As a foreign correspondent for CBC's The National, she traveled the globe covering stories like the war in Bosnia, the fall of communism, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Since 2002, we all know her as the front of CBC Radio 1's The Current, a program of perspectives, ideas, and voices that makes us think about the issues that affect Canadians and the rest of the world. The Current was honored with the Canadian Journalism Foundation's 2002 Excellence in Journalism Award for its commitment to accountable, hard-edged journalism. Anna Maria accepted the award with her team, and she gave what can only be described as a barn-burning speech. It's still our most viewed YouTube video, so I encourage you to check it out, where she encouraged journalists, especially the young ones, to take your journalism back and to fight for the stories that matter. We're thrilled to have her here tonight. Please join me in welcoming veteran journalist and early riser, Anna Maria Tremonti.
Thank you for coming out on such an awfully cold night. I don't know what that's about, but anyway, it's great to have everyone here and to have this discussion with Sarush. Now, let's go back 7 years. The fall of 2007, Toronto International Film Festival highlights a new documentary called Heavy Metal in Baghdad. It's compelling, candid, very human, a look at what it's like to live in post-Saddam Iraq through the eyes of members of Baghdad's only heavy metal band. Now, somewhat surprisingly, the doc comes from Vice magazine. Associated originally primarily with hipsters, outrageous satire, punk rock attitudes, lots of potty humor, and belligerence to spare. And there he was, Sarush Alvi, one of the founders of Vice magazine, now Vice Media, unveiling a new and inevitably blossoming side of what is now nothing short of a media empire. Sarush has been at the helm of every step of the way over the last 20 years, of all things Vice. He has moved from, all of Vice has moved from a satirical screed to serious and still belligerent, sometimes questionable, also competitive and even groundbreaking journalism. Sarush Alvi has traveled to and reported from Iraq, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Gaza Strip. I could continue, there's more. In an era where journalists are being laid off by the hundreds, where newspapers and media organizations are shrinking, where infotainment and puff pieces and drivel can dominate because it's what the public wants, where the media bosses shrug and say the business model doesn't work anymore, Sarush Alvi and his partners created a new business model, and the more successful it has become, the more journalistic it strives to be. Talk about countercurrent. Sarush Alvi, we have so many questions. Welcome to Toronto. And of course, you're from Toronto.
I was born in Toronto. Thank you very much, Anna Maria, and thank you to CJF for inviting me, Natalie and Wendy. That was pretty amazing intro. Covered a lot of ground.
Well, let's look at some of this. Let's unpack some of this, because heavy metal in Baghdad is often cited as a key moment in the transformation of Vice. Mm. Did it feel like that when you were shooting the documentary? Like, what were you thinking? You showed up in Baghdad.
It was, at the time when it was happening, you know what things were like in Iraq at that time. It was the summer of 2007, the height of the insurgency. It was a terrifying place to be. There weren't very many journalists there at the time. And for us, it was essentially the first time we had been in an environment like that, a conflict zone. I had only done a little bit of filming in Pakistan before that. And we didn't have a support team or any infrastructure. We just literally flew in by the seat of our pants, Eddie and myself, sneaking into the country. So that in itself was just, kind of insane, and the way it made us feel to be in that environment. And then once we started filming and we tracked down the subjects of the documentary and we connected with them and started getting their story, at that moment we knew that we had stumbled across something that was quite special. And as soon as we started rolling a form of the film out online, the reaction that we were getting, we knew we were onto something at that point, in terms of the audience reaction. And at that point, we decided as an experiment to cut it into a feature-length doc and submit it to TIFF to see what would happen, and it got accepted into the festival, and on that day, we became filmmakers, kind of by accident. And that then opened up, brought us into a new era for the company. And for us, personally, in terms of the work that we do, it was a revelation, and it changed the direction of our business.
And I want to talk more about the business in a minute, but let's talk a little bit more about what you were doing in Baghdad, because it became emblematic of how you have shown us stories from places that we hear about in the news. Mm-hmm. You focused in on a slice of life and a group of people who would otherwise not even get the attention of anyone in the media. Mm-hmm. And you brought us like an understanding that war goes on. And you brought us an understanding about like what goes on in a war zone. It's not all bang bang. It's people trying to get on with their lives, yeah, even in difficult situations. How important was that to you?
It was, I don't know. If it was, we were just doing it because it felt like the right thing to do. There wasn't necessarily an agenda attached apart from chasing a story that we thought was amazing. We wrote about it in the magazine, and we grew obsessed with these guys. Like, who are these young guys playing metal in the middle of the war? We have to track them down. That was basically it. At the time when we rolled out the film, America and probably the world were suffering from Iraq fatigue at that point. People were sick and tired of hearing about the war. And the story being reported, at least in the States, was the surge. Should we send in more troops or pull them back, or what are we doing here? It's a mess. And that was basically it. And then when we rolled out our film, our audience, our young audience, were so grateful that they were getting a real story about what it's like for young Iraqis. And, that was, again, kind of a message for us that our audience wants to consume content like this, and they want the real story, and they want, they don't want us doing stand-ups and in the safe confines of a hotel. They want to see what's actually happening on a street level. So I think it was that taught us a lot, and from there it kind of guided us about the type of content we were about to embark on.
It's interesting because what you're kind of telling me is that you followed your instinct.
Yeah.
And I want to talk a little bit more about that in the growth of Vice and even the creation of Vice. Let's go back to the start of Vice magazine, 1994. How did that come together?
Well, it was, again, I had, you know, an inner desire to work for a magazine, but I had never done it before. And through, you know, luck and circumstance and serendipity, I was introduced to a group of Haitians who had been publishing a bilingual magazine, and it was called Image Interculturelle, and they wanted to become French only, and they basically gave me a desk, a fax machine, a phone, and a computer, and said, go make this English magazine. I didn't realize that it was a way for them to scam grants from the Quebec government. And for me, it was the greatest opportunity ever, because at that point, I had dropped out of grad school, didn't have a lot going on. That's an understatement. And it was a huge opportunity for me. And so we had this tiny little office in Old Montreal, and I just started. And I knew that, you know, my worst case scenario was that I was going to create one issue of one magazine, and that would be it. And I could walk around and say, I did this. Or maybe it could grow to be something huge one day. And I kind of felt deep inside that this could, you know, I had a feeling. And a friend of mine encouraged me, and he just said, what have you got to lose? And the answer to that was absolutely nothing. And so I put all my energy into it. I was obsessed and consumed, and that's where we started. And I just grabbed people from around Montreal in the arts community, got them all involved in terms of the writers and the artists, and it was such a fantastic community of creative people in Montreal at that time. Everybody was poor, and everyone was supportive and wanted to get involved in this new project. And on a kind of local level, we created a lot of excitement, and we essentially created a magazine for ourselves that we could read. I felt like there was a void, there was a need for a magazine like ours, that I wasn't getting, you know, what I wanted from the public, the magazines that were out there, all the weeklies in Canada at that time. I felt that they were really boring. And so we just, again, and maybe it was not having been to journalism school and not having experience, there was kind of an advantage to that on some, like, ignorance is
bliss.
So
you didn't know the rules, and so you broke the rules.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and so you and your two business partners, Shane Smith, Gavin McGinnis, you break off to start this.
That's right.
How'd you get your funding?
Well, in the second row, my parents are sitting here. And I would like to say that without their support and investment of $5,000, it wouldn't have happened. So Gavin borrowed $5,000 from his parents. Borrow is the wrong word. My parents gifted me $5,000. And Shane, his investment came in the form of computers that his dad gave us, because his dad was in IT. And that was it. We broke off from the Haitians. We changed the name from Voice to Vice. And at that point, we had started shipping copies of the magazine to the States, and we're getting a phenomenal response and reaction from San Francisco, LA, and New York. They were, you know, completely, you know, freaked out. Like, what is this magazine? Where is it from? Our take on their culture was very different from what they were getting. And I think it was very raw at the time. And
well, you were having the people that normally people interview, you had them write their own stories,
yeah,
right?
We were trying to get as close to the source as possible. Now, with that, there were a lot of typos. It was poorly designed and poorly written, and we didn't even have an English spell checking. We had these French computers at the time, and so it was riddled with typos, but it still connected with people, and that was the important thing.
So let's just do the calculation here. So you guys all borrowed a little bit of money from your parents, $5,000 from your parents, $5,000 from the other one, and then probably $5,000 worth of computers from $15,000 investment. What's Vice Media worth today?
The most recent valuation is at $1.4 billion as of a couple months
ago.
That's
B. He said B, billion. Well, what was the original mission of Vice magazine?
I think You know, the original mission was to fill a void on a very simple level. It was to create the most authentic content we possibly could. And that was, you know, the search for authenticity and the quest to do that was what drove us. And we, you know, in terms of the type of content we did, it was all over the place. Culture was an important part of it, music, art, film, but politics were international affairs and were very, I would say, we were really interested in going there, but we didn't have the resources at the time. And I think, you know, as Canadians living in America now, our perspective is a bit broader than the Americans. And I think that has connected and resonated with a lot of our, you know, American audience as well.
You went to MTV at one point and gave them a pitch. Tell us what you said.
So there were, you know, a couple executives, one key executive at MTV who I think was very concerned about the fact that his kids weren't paying attention to what's happening in the world. They weren't watching the news. They're watching, you know, Pimp My Ride and The Real World, My Super Sweet 16, whatever these shows are. And I think he was a bit horrified at what MTV was doing to American culture. And so he came to us and he said, if we gave you some money to make a DVD, what would you do? And we came up with this pitch of 60 Minutes meets Jackass. speaking in language that I think they could understand. And they bought into it and they gave us a budget to make a DVD. And that is, with that money, we went and that was the first filming we did. We started filming Heavy Metal in Baghdad then. Gun Markets of Pakistan was a piece that I had written about in the magazine, and then we went and filmed it. And again, that was the big moment. That was the revelation for us once it came out, that even though it was raw, kind of like the magazine was, it was rough around the edges, but it was connecting with people. And from there came VBS, which was our online television network. But that was one of those pivotal moments for us in the course of our history.
You on your web channel, before you merged it into vice.com, you had a tagline, rescuing you from television's death-like grip. What was television doing wrong that you wanted to do differently? What was it that you were watching that you said, no way, we won't do that?
I think it was, you know, this kind of standard operating procedure that exists with this old guard in media. And I see it whenever I'm traveling and reporting. And not to take shots at you know, these kind of old school journalists who've been out there risking their lives to tell these stories. But I've seen it so often where they don't leave the hotel. These journalists who go or report in the networks and they operate from within the confines of the hotel. They do stand-ups from on the outside of the hotel, but don't actually go out. They're just sending their local stringers out to get the story. And by doing that, you're separating yourself and creating distance from the story and the subjects. And for us, I mean, that's why our audience was connecting with what we were doing. They were loving the fact that they were getting to see what was really happening in Baghdad at the time. And so on that level, we were rescuing people from boringness, if that makes any sense.
And you have continued to do this Baghdad-Gaza Strip, getting into Gaza, looking around, talking to people on all sides, looking at crime and punishment, I think you called it, in Gaza, because it's a tough place to live. One of your correspondents, right on the front lines of a divided town on the edge of Syria. What is the reaction from your audiences? What are you learning? What are they telling you?
That they want more. They want a lot more of the type of content we're making. And that is what is driving us forward so that we can deliver that to them. I think that we have this incredible opportunity right now And I feel like this is a global issue, that there is that the youth are somewhat disenfranchised by what they're getting. And with our HBO show, it was kind of proof that people are ready to get their news from people like us. And that was kind of a big deal for us, I think, because it legitimized us in the eyes of a lot of the kind of like old school traditional and the people with money. And so that was good. And that's why we're launching the Vice News vertical imminently in the coming weeks. And it's just going to be a lot more content of the type that we already do. But, you know, we do a lot of long-form content. We're going to be doing short-form content and covering breaking news as well. It's not going to be a 24-hour news channel yet, but we're going to be getting a lot more, young people. It's like news for a young audience by a young audience. So I'm kind of like older than that. So we're going to be getting a lot of these kids in the mix and getting them in front of the camera, and a lot more hosts.
You know that the old school both admires what you're doing and has criticized it for quote-unquote cowboy journalism, for maybe not enough accountability. How do you respond to that? Are you changing at all because of your association now with HBO?
Well, I think, HBO has been a fantastic partner for us. They've given us a lot of freedom and been incredibly supportive. But I think they are also taking a risk by working with Vice because they haven't had a news show before. So their reputation is on the line. So maybe they would have done this anyway, but it's an extremely rigorous process in terms of the amount of vetting that takes place by the lawyers on our side and their side. And I feel like that's a very healthy process to go through because it forces us to be on point and to not make mistakes and to have our facts straight. And that's something we didn't really do early on.
Are they cramping your style?
No. No, and, we had a show with MTV before, and they did cramp our style. They were like, it was an absolute fucking nightmare working with MTV, whereas HBO, they've been great.
What made MTV a nightmare?
The type of, it's this thing in, TV land or Hollywood, the executives love to write notes on a piece of content. And they were just sending so many mixed messages, and they ended up taking our content and making it fast, trying to pack 5 segments into a half-hour episode. And, that's maybe the type of content that's consumed by 15-year-old girls. We don't make content for 15-year-old girls, whereas with HBO, we're allowed to let the content breathe a bit more. And even that 11 to 13 minute segments are quite short for us, as we're used to doing longer form.
Interesting because, people, you have a younger demographic audience, and people say young people don't have an attention span. They don't want to watch that long stuff.
Yeah.
So what have you learned about who comes to see you, who hangs, who keeps coming back, and what they're interested in seeing? What have you learned about how much appetite there is for what you can give them?
I would say that our the kind of metrics that we have and our ability to spot the trends of our audience and what they want has really improved recently compared to how much we could look in and see. Before, we could just see how many people were watching it, and now we're getting a better sense of what they want. And, for sure they want more females hosting content. That's right. We're working on it. And that's something that we're addressing. All I can say for sure is they want a lot more of the type of content that we do. And they don't like it when it's too short. They don't like it when we break it up and make it episodic and make them wait for content. They hate that. They want it all at once, immediately. Yeah.
I want to ask you about Dennis Rodman and North Korea.
Do we have to?
We have to. We have to go there. Vice Media organized his first trip there. What were you doing? What were you thinking?
We were thinking that we needed to get into the country. And we had, Vice had been to North Korea twice before. And when my partner Shane had been there to film the Vice Guide to North Korea before, he saw a basketball that had been given as a present from Madeleine Albright to Kim Jong-il at the time that was signed by Michael Jordan. And we knew that the family, the Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-un, that they were obsessed with the Chicago Bulls. And we knew that for the finale of the HBO show, having a North Korea episode would be huge. So how do we get in? So we came up with this harebrained idea that we'll bring a Chicago Bull. And it worked. So Dennis Rodman wasn't our first choice. We tried Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, and that did not, we couldn't get them. But Rodman was available. Surprise, surprise. And again, we didn't know that once we were in, if Kim Jong-un was going to show up. But he showed up to the basketball game that we organized and was sitting next to Rodman. And so in total, the number of Western people who have met Kim Jong-un in terms of journalists or whatever boils down to about 3, and they're all working in our Brooklyn office, which is insane if you think about it.
It's incredible, yeah. You also had the Globetrotters. You had three,
and we brought the Globetrotters as well. Okay. Yeah, and it was a basketball diplomacy was the idea. And
you did so. What, you never intended that Rodman would become the best friend of the dear leader?
We weren't expecting that. We weren't expecting him to go off the rails simultaneously as well. So it was
define off the rails, just so we know what you're talking about.
I mean, I probably shouldn't say this, but you know, I think he started imbibing a little too much and maybe hadn't for a while before. And then he became uncontrollable and started saying things, insulting the leader of North Korea, not to his face, but to like a portrait on the wall when he was out of his mind. Which,
of course, if you do that and you're a North Korean, that gets you in prison.
It could have
life.
Got our entire crew thrown in jail. And so they then freaked out and were calling us saying, get them the hell out of the country ASAP because we're all going to end up screwed. So
that was the first trip.
Sorry?
That was
Rodman's first trip.
That was his first trip, but then he went back.
And then he went back, and then I think he got kicked out as
well.
But
you hold no responsibility.
We have nothing to do with that, no.
Okay.
But he, you know, it worked. And people then, again, started calling it stunt journalism, and we got a lot of flack for it, but we ended up getting a great story, and a lot of people know about Vice now who didn't know about Vice before. So it was a success and good for our company.
Would you do it again? Or something like that again?
I mean, for the sake of this conversation, let's call it stunt journalism. That's not what we do. But, you know, if there was a situation that called for some kind of, you know, insane idea like that, we would consider it, I guess. But that's not what we do. That's not our business model, and it's not, you know, it was kind of a one-off.
Let's talk about the business model. How many Vice entities are there?
So we have, 35 offices around the world, and within the Vice, kind of Vice.com portal, there are channels, verticals we call them, and we have Noisy for music and the Creators Project for the art side, Motherboard for tech, and then we have Fightland, which is a kind of UFC affiliated site, and then we're launching Vice News and Vice Food and Vice Sports. So all of these, and then we have the record label, and we have a book publishing division, and we have an in-house agency called Virtue, which is not really public-facing, but does a lot of work with brands. So there is a lot. That's why it's Vice Media. And there's the magazine. I almost forgot to mention the magazine, the thing that started it all. And the magazine is profitable and does well.
How many people work for Vice?
There are about 1,000 employees worldwide. I think you have, didn't we have a little fact sheet? I forgot. You know, it's crazy how fast it's growing and how many new faces there are in our offices every time. On a week by week, I go away for a trip and I come back and there are all these new
faces.
There
are new people.
And I'm like, who hired them? Who are they? Where did they come from?
Well, I'm going to ask you because we have a real mix of an audience in here tonight, but we also have journalism students who might even have their resumes with them. And maybe some CBC people, I don't know. Anyway, how do you hire? What do you look for in who you hire?
I mean, it really depends. It's case by case, but people have always wanted to work at Vice, and I think it's become an even more attractive place for students who are coming out of school right now. But because it's, you know, a proper corporation now with a lot of employees, we need some older people to help manage it. Otherwise, it's just chaos, right? It's in order to have it run like a well-oiled machine. And chaos was one of our issues. We're growing so fast and we're hiring and the energy and spirit in the office is fantastic, but it kind of, you need to have like a mom and dad figure in there as well.
I'm available.
We should talk afterwards. Okay.
I'm just wondering. Because if you look at your own trajectory, you didn't study journalism. You had a dream, but you weren't quite sure how you were going to get there. You tried to get hired, I think, before you started your own magazine. So what's the lesson in there? Are you looking for people like you were back in the day? Are you looking for something else?
I mean, there's so much going on at Vice right now, so many divisions and entities and type of projects that we need to hire for, you know, producers and cameramen and camerawomen and writers and brand strategy people. You know, it really depends. We want passionate people, people who are who really get it. And we definitely have our own weird culture at Vice. And so it can be a little tricky at times. But it's also important for us to kind of be open, have a, like, kind of, not open-minded, that's the wrong word, but to now bring in people who have experience at kind of the larger corporations as well. And they are actually bringing a lot to the table because we need their experience. And in order for us to deliver a show to HBO, we couldn't have done it without people who had real TV experience, who had worked at real places before. Left our own devices, we wouldn't have been able to pull it off. So it's the right blend of this kind of young, crazy kind of energy with, and to balance it out, some people with experience. So it depends what we're looking for, but we're hiring across the board.
Because I'm really struck by the fact that, yes, you needed people who had the experience, but if you had not come at it the way you had, you wouldn't have had the success. We have heard so much talk in the last, decade of people saying the business model for journalism, the business model for media companies isn't working anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I have actually said to journalism students, you're going to have to find a new business model because the people running the industry are out of ideas. And then you come along and you did create a new business model.
We got into the space at the right time. And again, it was because we were, you know, my brother and I refer to this phenomenon as stumbling upwards in life. And I think with Vice, we've done that a few times. And again, it's like these executives who were like visionaries at the same time seeing what we were doing and saying, you know what, you guys should go launch an IPTV network, or you should go make a DVD, or our friend Spike Jones saying, you guys have to film your stories. Things that we weren't doing and we just started doing. And what that meant is that now we have like a 7-year head start on the competition. And while old school print is scrambling to figure out how to bring in video. We've actually been hacking away at it and figuring it out and learning that it's actually not cheap, it's not easy, and it has to be at par with high quality TV content, even though it's the internet. And so we had to, like, the same way we went to school in public with the magazine, we did the same thing on the video side. And the result is that we got pushed into the digital space and the video in the digital space early. And that's given us an incredible advantage now.
It's interesting. It was like you leapfrogged over traditional media into that digital space when it was so fresh.
Yeah.
And kind of took ownership of it. And now you're coming back into the traditional and you're stepping on them. It's really interesting. And then at the same time, you need them as your investors. Viacom's a big part of your future, right?
News Corp has recently acquired a small stake for a good amount of money that we're taking that money to invest in the news space. And so we've always done this, worked with the corporations and taken as much money as we could to, whether it was for the record label or the books or to launch an IPTV network. So the Viacoms and News Corps of the world, we need them, but they will not own us, and we'll never do that.
How do you stay fresh? How do you do that? How do you keep yourself moving forward and being different?
I think you mean in terms of like the content we make or the business?
And in terms of how you move forward, because you really have leapfrogged over and now they all want a piece of you, but you don't want them to drag you into the terror, what did you call it, the death grip of television.
Yeah, I think the challenge we have now is how do we create a lot more content and maintain the quality to grow and to deliver a lot of TV shows. We're doing 2 TV shows this year just in America, and then we have other shows in Germany and Mexico and Australia that we're doing in those territories. But I think we're going to reach the point where we have to deliver a lot of shows, and we have to make sure that we maintain the quality of our brand and the quality of our content, because that's our reputation. And so often you see things grow and get big and become shitty, and that is what we have to avoid doing. So I don't know if that answered your question, but I think that's one of the big challenges that we're going to be faced with over the next couple of years.
My other question is when you sleep, because you are a co-founder and you're really very involved in moving this company forward, but you're the guy who still goes out and does a lot of the field work, and that's a lot of work.
It is, and I think over the last couple of years, I farmed out a lot of the day-to-day operational things. I went from managing 75 to 100 people to basically managing no one, and recently I can just focus on the content. And that's what I signed up for 19 and a half years ago when I started the magazine, because I had this dream that I wanted to make an interesting piece of content. And along the way, had to do a lot of, take the circuitous path. And it's been this epic saga of facing bankruptcy and bringing it back together. But getting back to this point today where tomorrow night I'm leaving to go to, Pakistan and Iran to film. And that's what I signed up for. So tomorrow night I'm flying, and we're embedding with the Pakistani army for 5 days in South Waziristan to get kind of a play-by-play on their battle with the Taliban. And then from there we fly to Iran, where we're doing a war on drugs story, talking about their war on drugs and also the kind of impact of the American war in Afghanistan and how that affected the poppy production, and the result is that Iran became a huge victim because of the American war, and they now have close to 4 million heroin addicts in Iran, which is crazy. And also we're going to Afghanistan as well. So it's a big kind of epic trip.
And the Iranians are going to let you in to do that.
So what's interesting is that the whole reason we went to Baghdad in 2007 was because we didn't get into Iran. And so that was, like, again, serendipity at the time. because we needed to, MTV had given us some money back then and we needed to get some content. So we've been trying to get into Iran since 2007, and we finally got our visas. And my crew is already on the ground, and we are encountering some challenges. But so far it seems that we have been given permission to do this kind of war on drugs story in Iran. We're also doing a food story for our food network, and also a story about sex changes in Iran. So we're like throwing softballs first and, you know, becoming friends with our government minders, and then we'll do this.
And they'll be with you 24/7, yeah.
Yeah, apparently, and then we're saving this other story for last when I get there.
Mm-hmm. And when you come back, are you going to be making like a full-length documentary, or are you looking for shorter things? This is the HBO series you're doing?
Well, that's a good question. I think some of this content will be for the HBO show for the end of season 2, which is just starting to air now. The middle of March is when we have to stop filming for the second season, and the rest of it will be for the Vice News site, which is launching soon. And that's also the beauty of this, is that we can go into the field, and I recently went to Cambodia to film something for our news channel, and it ended up on the HBO show. And so it's really, we have a whole kind of menu, a variety of options of where our content can live. And the same way Heavy Metal in Baghdad launched VBS, we need a killer piece of content to launch the Vice News vertical and kind of put it on the map. So it might be better to create a longer form piece in Iran and save it for Vice News as opposed to putting it on the HBO show.
Yeah, I'm guessing either Iran or South Waziristan, you're going to get a killer piece of content. We'll see.
Fingers crossed.
So how do you decide what's the process? Do you say, I want to do this and I'm going? Or is it like the process of actually assigning and deciding you're going to work on this story? Give us a little
for
bit
me,
of insight.
For me, personally, it's really kind of instinct-based. And if I get excited about a story, then I kind of discuss it internally and I'll go do it. But, you know, we were talking about this today, about how you work with producers for your show that you do every day. And it's really smart to listen to all of these producers that we have. And they have so many ideas. So we now do have more of a process and a system in place to figure out what's going to get greenlit. But ultimately, it's still very kind of instinct-based as well. But for the news vertical, obviously, you know, you look at what's happening in the world, and Kiev's blowing up, and Venezuela's blowing up, and we know that we need to be there on the ground, and we'll get the crews out there, and we're live-streaming from those places. And I think one of the great things about what we're doing is we're learning as we go along and can change it up, and the rules haven't really been written. It's kind of like the Wild West, and if something doesn't work, it's okay. We just won't do it again. Whereas I think with a lot of the big networks, things are just written in stone, and this is how it's going to be. I could be wrong about that, but I kind of have a feeling.
Well, I think you're right. I think that people get entrenched, and so you're trying to stay not getting into any ruts or entrenched. At the same time, that you're not going to do 24/7 news, but you're going to have a consistency, right, with the news channel.
Yeah.
How many people are going to be out there gathering?
I don't have an exact number, but we are hiring a lot right now in terms of producers, and not just in our U.S. office, but in our international offices. So, again, to be a big proper news channel, we need a lot of content. So we're kind of easing into it, and we'll see. You know, I don't know how many. The good thing is that we have 35 offices around the world now, and we were launching all these offices and territories, and at a certain point we weren't really sure why we were launching offices in Poland, or, you know, like, we just did it because there were people in these territories who were approaching us saying, we'd love to launch Vice in Poland. So we're like, all right, great, it's cool. There was like no kind of, it wasn't very sophisticated the way we were rolling out these offices at the time. But now it makes sense. We have a global footprint. And we can mobilize our infrastructure and use it to bring in content from around the world. And so for what's happening in Kiev, we Our UK office sent a crew from their office. What's happening in Venezuela, our Vice Mexico sent a crew from their office. And it's not us getting on the planes to tell every story, which is good.
You know, it's really interesting listening to you talk. Do people call you a visionary?
No. No, I don't think so.
I'm interested because you studied philosophy.
Did
you not?
Yeah. It's true.
And you are explaining how you open these offices and you just like you again follow your instinct.
Yeah.
So what can the rest of us learn from you?
I mean, in my case, it was getting completely consumed with an idea and being just pursuing my passion as much as I could and just going with it and maybe taking some risks. And even when it felt wrong or when it wasn't going well, just sticking with it and battling and creating an opportunity where there was none. And again, I think there's like ignorance is bliss on some level. If I knew what we would have had to do, I don't know if we would have done it. But it was a good, like in Montreal at the time when we launched, it was going through one of its economic downturns as they do in Quebec, you know, and it was, there were already two other English magazines in a shrinking English market. And then I come along and decide to launch another English magazine. It made absolutely no sense. There was not kind of, you know, an economy to support that magazine. And everybody else laughed at us. They're like, that is a stupid thing to do. But we didn't know any better. And so we did it. And I think we found a way to make it work.
You know, I have a friend who tells me that sometimes you shouldn't try to be ahead of the curve. Your best, and this is journalistically too, that you're best to go behind the curve. You let everyone else run around the curve, mm-hmm. and then you follow them, and you pick up all the things they dropped because they're so eager to get around that curve and be ahead of the curve. And in a way, that's what you did. You came behind all of these big media organizations, and you picked up what they thought wasn't valuable online. I work for a big media organization. I know online was not seen as very legitimate, taking it to digital, right? So you took what other people didn't think was valuable as they ran around that curve.
That's insane.
And I mean, look who's laughing now.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, for the big networks and, okay, this is the same thing happened in the music industry where they're all riding so high on the hog, you know, they're making bank, everything is good, and then the internet comes along and starts decimating things, but they don't change. And it takes them, they have to wait until they're completely broken down and desperate, and then they start making change. And I think for old school media, that change was coming, and they weren't nimble, and they didn't adapt. And now they're changing where maybe it's too late for a lot of them, and they're going the way of the dodo, you know? I think people get really stuck in the standard. When things are good and they're making money, it's like, here's our model, and it's going to go. Maybe. It's a theory.
I look at what you're doing, and I'm wondering if the 24-year-old who started Vice, what he would think of you 20 years later.
I can't believe it's been 20 years. I mean, that part of it's crazy to me. It's just, it's flown by. I mean, I think it's pretty miraculous, really, the circumstances around how Vice started, where we came from, our lack of experience, our lack of everything, and just based on pure ambition and maybe aggressive behavior, and how that led to where we are now and today, and getting the right people involved along the way and partnering up with the right people who, what we were doing resonated with people around the world. And so there was a guy in the UK who loved what we did, and he became our partner and rolled out all these European territories for us. And now he's the president of Vice Media worldwide, you know, and like, but he was a crazy person living in the UK. And there were these other crazy people around the world as well who came to us. And so I think we have our own kind of, it's a bit of a cult on some level. You know, not a cult, but it was connecting with a certain kind of person. And I think, I'm thinking about the day where I was walking down the street on Boulevard Saint-Laurent, and my friend said to me, what have you got to lose? Maybe it'll be huge. And that's like once in a lifetime type things. That I realize how rare it is and how fortunate we are, and I'm very grateful for that.
Where do you think the next wave will come 20 years from now?
You know, I don't know. I remember a few years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, we used to say, somebody's going to come along and start a magazine that's going to be way better than Vice, and that's going to be our death knell. Like, it'll be over. And that never happened because of the internet. You know, like, it's so hard to start a magazine and to make it profitable and make it work. Now, granted, there are a ton of new sites that have more traffic than we do, and but I don't know what the next wave is going to be. We are still riding our wave and still growing, and we still have more of the mountain to climb still. But we are unique. Vice is unique out there. And like I mentioned to you earlier today, we have finally become a true alternative. We used to say we were alternative, but it didn't mean anything because we didn't have an audience. But now we have more than 100 million people, and that kind of means something now. It's a significant number. So, yeah, it's. I'm not sure what the next wave is going to be, what they're going to do.
Well, I think a lot of people have questions, so I'll
has it already
I'll stop
been an hour?
It there. It's, oh, it's. I'll stop it there and open it up. Sarush, there's lots to talk about here. And how do you want to do this? We do have a microphone, okay. I will ask you to keep your questions to the point. No lectures, please, so that we can get as many questions as possible in. And go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question that comes from your bureau in Mexico. I'm told by the human rights officer at the British Embassy in Mexico City that there seems to be less concern about the safety of the journalists who are working on your stories in Mexico, which, as you know, is an extremely dangerous place. Mm-hmm. What are you doing to ensure the safety not only of the journalists who are working in the field, but also the people that are interviewed? Who may be identified and then are left to their own devices to figure out how to stay safe. Thank you.
Thanks. We have we've started doing hostile environment training for our producers. We did the first round of it last year, where 20 of us went and did, you know, first aid training and that kind of thing, and that's very important as we move forward to make sure that, because before it was just a handful of us who were out there taking the risks and going to these conflict zones or places where you've reported from for a chunk of your career, and now we have a responsibility to our employees and our people, our producers, to go out there and to give them the tools that they need to be safe and make the right decisions when they're out in the field, and not to send people out willy-nilly who don't have the experience. I mean, that's a really bad idea. So we are very, very conscious of that, and it's something to be worried about as well, because there's that youthful kind of enthusiasm that they want to go into a war zone, and that's probably not a great idea, you know, without the right support. What was the second part of the question?
Just about the people who are interviewed.
All right. So we've always tried to make an effort to protect our interviewees as much as possible where it makes sense, and to hide their identities if we needed to. We don't really have, you know, a policy, But apart from the idea that we want to, you know, be sensitive to these people who are sharing their stories with us and enabling us to do our jobs so that we get to get on planes and leave and we're not leaving them behind in a situation where they could get killed. So we're very conscious of that. It's case by case.
Go ahead.
I'm curious what your vision is for media consumption over the next 10 to 15 years.
I mean, I think mobile is obviously going to be playing a big role in the way people consume media. I mean, it seems crazy. There's an infomania out there. You know, there are so many different ways to consume media right now, and it's only increasing. And I don't know, it's not necessarily a good thing either. But I'm not really sure which way it's going to go. But I definitely think that the way we consume media right now is creating a lot of bad habits out there, and it's giving all of us ADD, you know, and just like there's so much information flying around. And, you know, you were telling me today that you're reading two books a week or something like that. Like, that's amazing that you find the time to be able to read. I'm finding it more and more challenging to finish books these days. So we should probably go
speed
to the next
reading.
Question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Good evening. My name is Samira. I'm a journalism student. And prior to coming here, I was talking with a friend of mine and saying how you lack any female broadcasters, as far as I can see. And I was happy that you mentioned it. What do you think the reason is for it?
Well, we do have probably four female hosts right now. There's one Iranian, Galare, who's going to be with me in Iran. And then we have Charlotte from the UK. We have a Pakistani female host, Fazila. So we have four right now who are, like, actively in the field and reporting. I think the reason was that we were doing all the hosting out of our New York office, and it was just a handful of us when we started, my partners and I, and that was it. And we have tried. I think, you know, it has to be the right kind of vibe, the right fit.
Sure.
And finding the right fit, and we're talking about, like, who do we hire? That's a challenge for us, getting the right fit. So somebody that kind of, you know, represents Vice properly at the same time. But, you know, we want nothing more than to have a lot more hosts and a lot more female hosts as well. So we'll talk afterwards. I can tell you their names so you can go watch their stuff.
They're on your trailer.
Right,
the
they're on the trailer. Yeah.
The trailer.
Thank you.
For the new program. They're all there.
One of the things I'm consistently surprised and happy with Vice is how many freelancers and new reporters they bring on, as opposed to this new online trend with, you know, Glenn Greenwald and Ezra Klein, who are poaching bigger journalists at well-founded organizations. And I just wonder if that's a conscious or a subconscious thing on Vice's part to bring up new reporters and as many freelancers as they can.
I think it's how we've always just done it, you know, and I think our network of freelancers is just growing exponentially all the time, and I think we have thousands of freelancers, both on the writer side and now the challenge is the producers that we bring on board for all the TV and video content that we're going to be making. But yeah, it's not necessarily a conscious thing, it's just how we've always done it.
Hi. So I was a big reader of Vice magazine in Montreal, and one of the columns that really sticks out in my mind is the Do's and Don'ts column, which had a very particular sense of humor and definitely tapped into something about, you know, my generation. I was wondering how much of that way of seeing the world as being like do's and don'ts factors into Vice's culture.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I mean, I guess it's like seeing things as like in this very stark manner of like, we're doing things this way, they do things that way. You know, like, does that help explain the question?
I think we've always, you know, we used to say we want to do smart things in a stupid way and stupid things in a smart way. And that was kind of our ethos in terms of the magazine content. It doesn't necessarily apply to a lot of our documentary work, which can be straight serious at times. But the Do's and Don'ts was just a fun kind of fashion critique column because we were so not fashion people that the idea of doing fashion advice made no sense. So we thought the best way to do it is just to have this Do's and Don'ts thing where we're just going to be assholes. And so, and it worked and was the most popular thing we've ever done.
Yeah. So. All right, thanks.
So are you asking, are they going to be assholes in their TV stuff? Or are they?
Kind of.
It's really hard to do that, like, on TV. We've been trying to, like, solve the Do's and Don'ts riddle for video, and it doesn't work. Working on it.
You did pitch 60 Minutes meets Jackass.
Right, it's true, we did. It didn't end up being that exactly, but it's close. Hi.
My name is Knight, Tim Knight. I'm the guy who, when you said you wanted some older people, I put up my hand
right.
And said, I'm available, so I just want to remind you later at the bar.
I'll meet you at the bar.
Said, okay, but I do have a question. Very early on, sir, you said that you had a very sweeping statement about journalists covering wars from hotels. Now, yes, I know there are some. We all know there are some. We also know there are a whole hell of a lot of journalists who go out and risk their necks every day. And I don't want it lingering in this audience that you think that all of us do the hotel reporting.
Absolutely, and I did
including,
say
including Anna Maria, by the way.
Sorry?
Including Anna Maria, who goes
right.
out.
Right, and when I said that, I did say that by no means am I talking about all the journalists who are out there risking their necks and doing great
yeah,
work.
Yeah, but it was a sort of...
But, you know, I'm saying things based on what I've seen out yeah. there. And 100%, like, it would be, you know, like, unacceptable to make a sweeping statement about journalists yeah. who are out there, especially, like, the freelancers who are out there on their own. Telling these stories and risking their lives to report. So, you know, duly noted, sir.
Thank you.
I didn't pick him up on that one, Tim, because I remember the very first time I started covering the first intifada in Israel. I was out with my crew in the West Bank, and we were covering riots, and they had a pockmarked car from all the rocks, and my crew is shooting, and I'm with them. And one of the crews from one of the American networks, which I won't name, said, "Who's she?" pointing at me. And he went, then the cameraman said, "My reporter." And they were, like, aghast that the reporter was out with the crew shooting, you know, just the daily intifada grind. I think we all know that there have been times, and yes, there are a whole bunch of journalists who risk their lives, and of course, it wasn't that long ago that Marie Colvin was killed in Syria, and I don't know anyone who didn't look up to her work. But it is true that too often people let the camera, let the crew, when they could, now people have to shoot their own stuff too, but they let the crew go and do some of the stuff, and they stayed back, and they went out very selectively. And so it's worth remembering that it's really important for people who are working with people who are shooting, everywhere they go, you go.
Yes.
Or don't cover. Like, don't go at all. Yeah. Next.
Hi. You were talking about disenfranchisement with youth and the type of media and stories that have been presented to them. So I wonder if you could talk about kind of what you think some of the most underreported stories are. And also your views on global warming, because I find that's a very underreported story, you know, in traditional media, and you guys have done a fair amount on that.
In season 2 of our HBO show, there's going to be an episode that speaks directly to the effects of global mm-hmm. warming in Greenland. And we have done some environmental shows and segments, like Toxic Garbage Island, for example, is probably the most viewed piece of video content that we've ever done, mm-hmm. More than Dennis Rodman, even. And whenever we do kind of work that relates to the environment, it does fantastically well. We always say green is gold right. in terms of the content of that ilk. So what do I think is not reported? I mean, I did a piece in the Congo, which I feel is a very important story that is underreported. Mm-hmm. you know, a lot of stories that we've done over the last 5-7 years have you know, we also end up in places where all the big networks are as well. Everybody's in Kiev, and we're there as well. You know, and Nigeria, I think, is quite underreported.
Yeah, Niger Delta story is great.
No, thank you. I feel like there's a lot going on. Africa generally is a very underreported place, I think. I think it's there are a lot of stories in Africa that we need to go pursue.
What are the stories you think need to be reported?
I think global warming's tough for me. You know, we don't talk about it enough. I think the amount of articles that have been in the news as it relates to climate change have gone down significantly since, like, 2007. You know, and it's, like, the biggest crisis of our generation, and we're not really talking about it enough. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hi. We've talked about the business model for Vice. I apologize. I should probably know it, but how do you make money? How do you pay for thousands of people? I'm sitting here thinking, good Lord, what am I doing wrong?
Advertising has been...
Is it an ad model?
I mean, we've always given away content for free since day one with the magazine and then online. The magazine always had 50% of its pages were ads and the other half were editorial. And then online we have, you know, multiple revenue streams that go around our content, whether it's traditional banner advertising or show sponsorship. And then we work closely with brands as well to create content that sometimes people don't even see. That keeps the lights on.
Are you doing a lot of native advertising or brand?
So what do you mean exactly?
Content, branded content. So big buzz right now for everybody is how the heck do I do branded content or native advertising and still maintain the integrity of my brand?
We don't do it like that. We don't even like to use the word branded content.
Right.
We will work with brands to make content, though. But it's a kind of a tricky space. We believe that if we are really transparent about working with advertisers and let people know, then it's okay.
So it's primarily ads, sponsorships, and that's sustainable for you, you think, going forward?
Yeah. Okay. Now, I mean, there have been, it is sustainable, but there's a lot going on at Vice, and so we do have other revenue streams as well. We have had investment as well. And then doing a show with HBO, for example, brings its own healthy, separate budget. So I think it's hard to make it work. A video-based site and run it on advertising is very challenging. And so you need to have crazy deals with brands as well to help finance that. But we believe in news so much that we're willing to let it be a loss leader on some level because it defines our brand on some level.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Can you give us an example of how you would use content with a brand?
So, I mean, the big example is the Creators Project, which was an initiative we did with Intel. And they, basically they came to us because they wanted to emotionalize their brand on some level. They don't have a brand. The brand doesn't have any meaning. They just have that bum, 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 bum thing that they do, right? And so we said to them, let us make content about that focuses on the arts community, whether it's, you know, designers, musicians, producers, and we'll make 100 documentaries, and we'll choose these people, and then we'll put it all online, and then we'll throw events around the world where these people will be involved. And that was like a very big ticket item for us. And it worked because, you know, and our audience knew that Intel was financing it, but they were okay with that because the content stood on its own and it was still compelling and interesting. So that's like a big example of working with a brand and going deep. And it worked. Intel did all their very research-driven and all the feedback that they got from their studies was that people like Intel more because of the Creators Project. So that was good. And that was extremely non-traditional advertising. But it allows us to get on the planes and go to Gaza Strip and tell that story. That certainly doesn't make any money on its own, right?
How long will you be able to continue to do that to make sure that you you don't worry about the money coming back in for your journalism projects?
I mean, I think now, because of the recent investment and strategy that we have for the Vice News vertical, we have a good 3 to 5 year plan. And, you know, the ultimate goal is to, I don't know where she went, but is to make that model work on its own. That would be the big win, where it's like Mutual of Omaha or like brought to you, like 1950s style, brought to you by Gillette, just underwriting the whole news play. That would be great. So,
go ahead.
Hi.
My
question for you is, you know, by your own admission in the early years, kind of having to use lower common denominator pitches to break down certain doors, like, for example.
Oh, can you put the mic?
Sorry.
Yeah, just move the mic up to you. Yeah. Okay.
How's that?
It's good.
Better.
It's great.
Yeah, that sounds better. So by your own admission, in your earlier years, having used lower common denominator pitches to break down certain doors, and thank you for that, by the way, like, I guess, by example, what you said with MTV. With emerging media trends that we can't necessarily foresee, and also changing newer voices and forms of media, can you imagine a scenario for yourself where just purely by competition with people catching up to you, where you actually might have to go back and sadly, unfortunately, maybe make a few more compromises or lower common denominator pitches? Like, I'm not suggesting, like, you know.
I have no idea what that question is. I'm sorry. Do you know what the question is?
What I mean is, like, if we start with, like, the kind of Wild Wild West scenario we have online, like newer forms of news, newer voices and whatnot, but kind of shorter attention spans, can you imagine, like, a horrible personal dystopian kind of future for yourself where all of a sudden, after having made it this far competitively online and with other medias, you have to have pitches like, a film documentary of former political leaders having a hot dog eating contest or something.
I hope not.
Yeah,
I really hope that we can get to the point where we can stop, like, working with brands one day and we can just make original content.
Awesome.
That would be the big win.
Awesome.
Stop working with brands completely. We're still going to be advertising based, the magazine and a lot of our other initiatives. But, you know, we have had to make a lot of compromises along the way to take certain steps forward.
And here's hoping that's...
Sorry?
Here's hoping that's no more. All right. Cool. Thank you.
Hoping. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to ask a bit about the McAfee incident that happened in 2012 and just sort of like what Vice learned from that. I guess I'll explain to the audience, unless Anna Maria, you're familiar with the John McAfee story.
Go ahead.
Okay. So in December 2012, Vice sent someone to see John McAfee, the guy who did the virus software. He's into some kind of sketchy stuff. And he was hiding out, and I think it was Guatemala. And the correspondent that Vice sent took a photo with him and put it on the internet somehow. The metadata was included, and the authorities found the GPS coordinates. And John McAfee had put out on Twitter, I knew about metadata, I put in fake data, that's not the real thing. And the Vice correspondent actually said the exact same thing. And then that turned out to be untrue, and McAfee was somehow, I don't know if he was arrested, but the authorities somehow found him at some point. I'm wondering, has Vice learned anything from that? And I'm just curious because Vice paints itself as alternative, and to me that's something that the media, I don't know if it's a maturity or if it's not really being honest with the readership. Has Vice learned from that at all, and what led to that happening?
Well, I mean, it was a blunder. It was a huge mistake on our part. and we ended up learning a valuable lesson. I mean, it was like a rookie mistake extraordinaire. But these things happen, you know, and we learned. It's the last thing in the world we wanted. And
like, not so much the metadata, but more like having a correspondent lie about that and misrepresent what happened.
I don't know about that, what part you're talking about specifically about the correspondent lying. But in terms of the, I mean, we can talk about that afterwards if you want to get into it more deeply, but in terms of that incident happening, that was like, you know, we ended up with egg on our face and the laughingstock of media, and everybody was so happy to jump on us and throw some punches our way, because it was after we'd been growing and getting so much positive press and we'd been in the media so much, and finally we gave an opportunity for everyone to say, haha, look, advice, they're a bunch of idiots, and isn't that great? So it happened. And it sucked at the time.
Yeah. Does Vice have, like, an ombudsman or anything?
Sorry?
Like, does Vice have an ombudsman? I'm just curious about
have
how
a
it's...
what? I'm sorry.
An ombudsman.
An ombudsman.
Or a public editor. I'm just curious as to how they structure that vis-a-vis how, you know, more traditional legacy media are looking after that.
I don't know what that means. I remember in college there was an ombudsman.
Yeah.
Well, right? CBC has an ombudsman.
Right.
Our first question
came
from the former CBC ombudsman. He
really?
Can tell you. Yeah. it's if you have a complaint with the organization or their coverage, you actually go to the individual department that you have the complaint with, and if you're not satisfied, then you take your complaint to the ombudsman, who then adjudicates and pronounces on. Or it's like there's a press council for newspapers. Some newspapers belong, not all do. It's that kind of thing.
That's
okay.
Interesting.
No, I was just curious.
Okay, thank you.
So, no, we don't have one. But okay. I take it that you wish we did so that you can file a complaint, which is totally
no,
fine.
No, I don't have a personal complaint, okay. But I'm curious as to, like, you're presenting a new media model, and I'm just curious as to how does dealing with inaccuracies or misdeeds of journalism, like, how do you deal with that as an organization?
I mean, I think transparency is the best way when those things happen, and don't try and hide from it and get ahead of it and put it out there.
So did you do a postmortem?
Yeah, absolutely. The person who made the mistake did not get fired, but they got kind of put on ice for a while, you know, had to spend some time in the doghouse. But, yeah, I mean, we did a postmortem, and like, how did this happen? Why did it happen? The person was working too long. They were too tired. They fucked up. These things happen sometimes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyway, thanks.
Anybody else?
Hi.
Hi.
So part of the red tape that comes with sending people to hostile zones is, first of all, you have to deal with the training, potentially, if you have insurance, and obviously, there could be lawyering and so on. So without naming any specifics, I recently heard of a situation with a freelancer, not with your agency. She's done stuff for a variety of networks. Had her jaw broken in Israel. Didn't have insurance there and had been away for so long that back home, they weren't willing to cover her medical fees either. So, I mean, you've talked about hostile training for sure. How do you deal with potentially freelancers working for you or even your employees when they might sustain injuries in these dangerous places that you're sending them to?
I mean, we have we have insurance, obviously, for whatever happens. You know, God forbid kidnapping. We have the K&R, kidnap and ransom insurance, and then we have, like, the traveling health insurance in case they have injuries when they're abroad. And the best we can do is, you know, deal with things case by case and just try and take care of them and get them home when something happens.
And as a follow-up, have you had any injuries along the way?
No, not... Well, we've had some injuries, but nothing that, you know, one hospital visit, getting a cast and, like, a broken arm, that type of thing. But that's, you know, thank God, been the worst of it so far. But we work with the Committee to Protect Journalists, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and they just said, you know, it's inevitable that something will happen if you go deep into the news space. And so we're trying to be very conscious of that and very vigilant and do everything we can as we move forward and grow into this space.
And was there a learning curve, or do you find that working with places like HBO gave you some additional insight into what you were doing?
No, the learning curve we did on our own, from our own experience, and HBO has been pretty hands-off. They, when we started talking to them, they saw our content and said, okay, you guys are basically, you know, your content is ready to, you know, we're not going to give you advice on how to make the content. They only write notes on the actual piece of content and ask questions and that kind of legal vetting process that we talked about or how to make it better, but they're not kind of coaching.
And I don't want to hog the mic, but just one last thing. So does that factor into where you're going to send people next? Like the insurance rates now and all of that jazz?
I mean, we're very concerned about who would go into a combat zone, if at all. You know, it's not a question of insurance, though. But you know, we had someone in our UK office that was very young and wanted to go into Syria when things were really bad, and we said, "No, you can't go. We don't feel good about this."
Thank you.
Thanks.
This question just relates a little bit back to the advertising question about how you maintain money being such an online presence. I work at a online media company too, and there's a lot of talk about page views as a metric to show popularity and success, especially when you're getting sponsors and advertisements. And there's also talk about time spent online, so how long a user will spend online reading an article versus how many clicks they go through. So it's kind of, you know, if you're a content creator, the page views critically kind of speak to, let's just build some gallery and get them to click through it, and the content kind of suffers. Does Vice have a model in place for what metric you use, and do you think the time spent online model or a model in the future is going to be more successful coming up?
Ryan, you want to help me with that? I have the director of one of the directors of Vice Canada here who knows a lot about advertising.
Yeah,
so
no,
be, field this one.
Because it would be great to know, because anybody who's in, you know, wants to create content now, this is kind of affecting all of us all the time. So I think this is something that everybody should hear.
Here, let me give you the mic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we still use time on site as one of our big measurements, mostly because we can go around and boast about it because we're way above average. We're about 20 minutes per session time on site, which is huge, which is greatly above average. So that's kind of a pretty good standard for us at this point. Where it's going, I don't know. That's to be seen. Right now, that's where it's at. I mean, measurements online are changing constantly, as you must be familiar with. So what the next thing's going to be, I don't know. But certainly stickiness and page views is a thing, too. I mean, it means people are interested in your content, and they're going to keep flipping through. Yeah, there is traps you can build in terms of, you know, putting up photo blogs where you just click whatever. But essentially, the more time someone's on a site, the more time they're engaged. And it all comes down to our ability to make good content, right? So if it's good, they're going to stick around. And so that's how we currently measure it. I don't know how where it's going to go in the future, but... Yeah.
Just to follow that up briefly, do you find that advertisers, since you've started in the history of Vice, in your case, are starting to gravitate a little bit more towards time spent online versus page views? Because that's something that us journalists are quite interested in.
You know, every advertiser seems to be different, interested in a different thing. It's a hard thing to answer. Really, honestly, they're still... The key measurement for them is how much traffic you're getting. That seems to signify how popular you are and how good you must be, which is dumbing it down a lot. But fortunately, we perform kind of across the board in all the metrics you want to look at. But yeah, in our case, it's just like if you have the traffic and the content looks good to them, then they want to partner with you. So.
Interesting. All right. I was hoping it was going to be all time spent online there, but no. Perfect. Thanks a lot.
We have time for one last question. Are we done? Wait, one last question.
I've done mine.
Okay, I think we're
right.
No.
Sarouche?
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.
Hi, my name is Jeffrey Dvorkin. I'm the co-chair of the programming committee, so you're my idea. So thank you so much for coming here. And I just want to say, in a previous life, I was an ombudsman for National Public Radio. Here's my card. I'd be happy to explain what an ombudsman does. I also have to say that as a teacher of young aspiring journalists, I have 60 or 70 young journalists at the University of Toronto who follow you quite religiously. So they can't pay any money yet, but they're definitely in the demographic that you want. So thank you, Suresh, so much for coming here and being with us. And thank you to Anna Maria, who is one of the great reporters. I have a story to tell you about that. And I tell my students about a report you did from Sarajevo during the siege. It's just such a powerful piece of journalism. I'm so delighted that you're still at the CBC informing all of us about what's really important. So thank you both very much, and thank all of you for coming. And thank you to Molson Coors for making this open bar available to you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you so much.
I'd be happy to. I was the executive director of the organization News Ombudsman.